the badge. Can you hear me? Anybody? How about in the back? Okay, great. Okay, I'm on a lavalier microphone, which, as you can see, is kind of important for me, so you'd actually be able to see me. So thank you for inviting me here. I've been trying to come to Access for, I don't know, since Art Rhino first approached me, I don't know, 2001, 2002, and I have tried really, really hard to get here. And so it's exciting to both be here and be a speaker. Let me get the trusty old PowerPoint up. And okay, I'll just drop that down. My talk, as some of you know, some of you who are on some of the IRC channels know that I finished my presentation about 7:45 today. But it's actually because I've been sort of working on it in my head for about a month. And really, last night I threw out everything I was working on and said, you know, I just realized that I'm in the middle of a really interesting project, and sharing my thoughts about openness and about open source from the perspective of that project is probably one of the more interesting things I could do right now, and share that with you. So I'm going to be talking to you about my work in open source software and about the very nature of open and what open means for library software. Just as a reminder, this is just a Wikipedia definition about open source software that allows anyone to make a new version of it and share it with others. And just to clarify, I'm the community librarian for Equinox, which is a support and development company for Evergreen, and that's Equinox in Norcross, Georgia, which is a suburb of Atlanta, which I believe is about 250 miles wide. And what I do is I drive around the state. One of my jobs is to drive around the state, talk to librarians, get my read bookmark made. I talk to them about Evergreen, about their experiences. I observe them in the field. I watch them at the CERC desk. I sometimes bring a systems operation persons with me to test the network and so forth. And then back at the office, although I work virtually, I actually live in North Florida, which, just to be clear, for those of you who aren't familiar with Florida, or at least with Tallahassee, when I say I'm in Florida, people think Miami. I am actually basically in South Georgia. So I'm 17 miles from the Georgia border, and these are the dots of libraries I've recently visited on my Google Maps. And in fact, you'll see that we're actually, Equinox is based up here in Atlanta. I'm down here, and that has had some interesting effects, by the way, in terms of visiting sites and getting familiar with the southern tier of libraries in our network. By the way, Equinox is hiring. We have two developer positions. There's been a very interesting revolution in the last 8 to 10 years. We've seen a lot of interest in open source software in libraries, and we've also seen libraries actually writing open source software. I see Eric there. A lot of the thoughts that I have for this presentation came from an article I've been working on with Eric's help about open source software and its development in libraries. It's really extraordinary. If you look back, if you think to 10 years ago, where we have come in a very short period of time with Evergreen Coa, Opal's All, Xcatalog, Library Find, Blackline, ViewFind, Fish4Info, Scriblio, SOPAC, Umlaut, IVIA, Django, LibX, SOPAC, and those are just viable projects, not to mention a million of things that have been experimented with or thought up or dreamed of. And in fact, this is the statement from an organization about how they are developing an open source code sharing infrastructure. Anybody know who this organization is? Yes, you're right. This is OCLC, who 10 years ago was suing a hotel in New York City for using the Dewey Decimal code to label its doors, and is now has a developers network encouraging sharing and openness. So we've really come in a very short period of time, very, very different mindsets happening now in the library development world, very different ideas about sharing and openness. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about Evergreen and how it came to be, because Evergreen just turned 2. And so it's in the terrible twos, but that's actually been kind of good times for Evergreen, as 2-year-olds go. And let's see how they got there. In 2000, there was a Y2K project in Georgia for its Pines network. And Pines is a consortium of 270 plus libraries spread out through Georgia. And Georgia is a pretty big state, and it's a very rural state. And driving around, I often will go, I have the best cell phone I can get, and yet there are many miles that I go where I am out of contact. When we say rural, we're talking really rural, where there's a house 5 miles, there's another house 10 more miles, there's a house. And that's like a library district can be huge. And these are small communities, poorer communities, communities that are extremely hard to network, communities that are in the very, very end of network connections in many cases. So the challenges of bringing a live catalog, out to these communities is pretty interesting. Well, the first catalog they got was kind of typical, you know, library software. Here you go, silos, you know, corn in one, wheat in the other. Got your, I won't mention any names, but it's a mythical animal. Put the emphasis on myth, because if it were really a horse, it could run. And within a very short period of time, they developed a number of problems. With a system of that scale, you need a lot of capabilities. You need powerful reindexing. You need powerful transaction handling. You need deduping. You need a lot of things that become much magnified in a system where you have 270 plus libraries. That's like the very extreme of what you can imagine in a consortial system. Even when they're small libraries, maybe especially when they're small libraries, especially with the challenges of staff and training. So the original four developers, well, first the first thing they did was they went out to other traditional vendors and they said, you know, they went through the traditional process, as you can see here, and they said, you know, we want to replace our ILS. Well, nobody could meet their needs, and in fact, several vendors told them that they didn't even want to deal with them, that it was not something that they even wanted to try, was the Pines network, that it was like, it's crazy, you can't have a consortium this big anyway. It's too many libraries for back-end processing and so forth. It's just not enough. And in fact, here, by the way, is the map of the Pines system, as it's called. And as you could see, all that green are Pines systems in Georgia, with a couple of holdouts, Savannah on the border. They were a holdout in the Civil War, too, I think. And in speaking of which, I want to take a brief detour and point out, this is a picture I took last week of a Confederate memorial outside of, right across the street from the library in Cairo, Georgia. And that's spelled C-A-I-R-O, and it's pronounced Cairo, as in, Miss Karen, come to Cairo. And sometimes when people think about rural public libraries in the South, they immediately assume a level of backwardness, you know? And yet what I have found in traveling around these libraries is they may be short on resources, but there's no amount of savviness and experimentation on some very interesting levels. And in fact, this is me last week. I don't know, any of you know what that small device is near my hand? That's a biometric device. I checked out a book in a Pines library using my index finger. So don't underestimate. The director said, I got so tired of having that patron mad at me because I told him he had to bring his car. I said, next time you bring your thumb. So, and he did. And I signed up for it. It was kind of cool. It is great. I don't have to fish my Pines card from my huge keychain at the bottom of my purse. I just put out my little old finger, check out my book, and I'm good to go. Again, 270 plus libraries, millions of records, and again, problems of scale. You have one library; it's not so big. You start to get a lot of libraries; it gets to be an issue. And then, if you want to grow, if you're at a system that is at the absolute threshold, and you have libraries clamoring to join, then you need to go. Oh, by the way, this is the master record. I know many of you have heard about the master record for years, and OCLC refers to it quite a bit. But this is actually the master record, this is what we were fearing in Pines, is that the system would, we felt we were on the precipice of the whole system collapsing and breaking. that the indexing in particular was becoming problematic, and there were a number of things that just didn't work. And we were scared of that, and we couldn't get a vendor to meet our needs. So what we did was, after talking to various vendors and rejecting their issues, was we decided we would build our own system. We were tempted, sorely tempted, by the fruit of open source. And there were four original core developers at Georgia Public Library Service. And these are developers reminding you that in a library, working for librarians, and in a couple instances, librarians themselves. So this is software that's born of a library. Here they are, the original development team. hard at work, as you can see. They began writing in 2004, even though people told them, oh, you know, that's silly. You can't write your own ILS. That's just not possible. Brad, to this day, our CEO, talks about, the condescension of, especially, to somebody in public libraries, you couldn't possibly write your own library software. In September 2006, they launched Evergreen in 258 libraries, and it was live and it was a success. And that was Evergreen 1.0. 1.1 came out 2 months later, and we've had several releases since then. 1.4, the release candidate for that is imminent. It was due out in September, and I've now said that September is such a short month, and then you have Labor Day at the beginning and so forth. So we're thinking it'll be like September 36. So, but we are really, really imminent on that release candidate. So we've stuck to development schedules, and it's really been. And big plus for working code. I mean, it worked. And that is right there something really, really amazing. Librarians wrote their own integrated library system. Now, this is not something brand new. This is a return to where we were 30 or 40 years ago. Recently, I finished an essay about my friend and role model, Ann Lippo, who died several years ago. And Anne, back in the early days of library automation, participated in one of the buildings of Melville. Back in those days, before the internet, there were libraries that wrote their own software and owned their own code. There were libraries that shaped their own destiny. And it's been said that if the internet had existed back then, with the ability to file share and so forth, that we might not have gone commercially, and that we might have stayed, that we might have, in fact, have invented open source in libraries. We strayed from that path and took some detours, and so we've really had not, this is not something new, it is something old that we're living new again, which is really kind of wonderful, and it brings us back to some very exciting times in library development, and brings us back to an ownership and sense of purpose about our software that I think is really significant. And we were happy. So Evergreen came out, and the reference librarians were overjoyed, and the masses thronged into the libraries. No, this is a joke. So this is from the 50s. The masses actually began using the system very heavily. Holds were designed to be easier to place, so we have this huge volume. We have this huge network effect happening in Evergreen, in the Pine system, where we've just seen holds go up exponentially and library use grow up. Now, some of that has been fueled by some of the economic situations happening in the United States, the fuel costs and even gas shortages. I literally changed my travel plans for next week because it is hard to buy gasoline in the South. I mean, I go to my local gas station and I can't put gas in my car. So I telework anyway a lot of the time, so I'm now making more short jaunts southward and canceling some of my trips. So we're having a lot of local library use. But it's also, the more people use a system and the more they like it and the more they share it with others, the more powerful it is. And that's a network effect, and we're seeing it with Evergreen. So it's not just the economy that's happening. Happy library users. Actually, this is also kind of a fake shot, because this is outside of Redwood City, California, because if it was in the South, he'd be covered with mosquitoes and he wouldn't be smiling, but that's another story. And in fact, we even have a mobile edition, which is pretty cool. So 2008 and 2009, okay, where are we now? Well, we've got 275 libraries in Pines. British Columbia Sitka will have 18 libraries total when everybody comes on board. I believe we've got a couple. We've got our first academic site. We've got several hosted sites now. We've got two sites come up in the Michigan Library Consortium, one with the Indiana State Library, and Niles coming up next week for Indiana. And in development, we've got King County Library System, Project Conifer, and National Weather Center Library, which is our first special library. When I say we, I'm really talking about the general Evergreen loose community of Evergreen users, developers, followers on. And these are only the known sightings. There is probably Evergreen. We've heard of Evergreen on school systems. We've heard of people using it for their home library. I mean, it's open source. You download it, you use it. You know, it's there to share, as we say. And the more use it gets, the better that is for everybody. And in fact, this is, speaking of things that are imminent, this is the new design for the OPAC for Evergreen. This will be, the classic skin is still available, but this is a prototype. It is live. Of the second stage of an OPAC design. Now, it's gone from a wireframe to going onto a live site, but it still hasn't been tested out in the field, and the developer is still putting in some findings that we found in our first round heuristics. But it is really pretty nice, and answers some of the design questions we've heard of. Also, I can later answer questions about where we are with acquisitions and so forth, and I even have it up live along with Rosie, our OPAC design. But what I'd like to do is move into some observations that I have about open source and libraries, both pro and con, from working in the field. The first one is, we have learned the hard way, if you don't do documentation as a prerequisite of the code, it doesn't happen. So documentation does not write itself. That's an easy bake oven. And there's sometimes a thought that, you know, oh, people will share the documentation, it'll happen. I think I've talked to somebody, Dan Scott, is he around? Hi, Dan. He and I think, have commiserated from time to time that the fact that writers don't get much respect. And there's often the assumption that it must be easy because everybody can do it. But if it were easy, you know, we'd see documentation. We were fortunate, though, to get a Mellon grant. Mellon's been very supportive of open source development in libraries to write documentation, and we've got a herd of documentation writers lined up to work on. Acquisitions will have documentation out of the box, and we're going back to write documentation for reports and cataloging and holds and everything else, because although it does tell you something about Evergreen that a whole lot of people have figured out how to catalog books with the paucity of documentation. I, who am not a cataloger, went in last week and played around and added holdings, and that was not so bad. But so we learned, it is true, you absolutely must make documentation a prerequisite with the code or it won't happen. Trickle-up engagement has been kind of an interesting case. I think at the beginning, we thought that participation would be automatic and that libraries would understand how to participate in open source development. In fact, I think that's one of the reasons my position was created was, in fact, there is a condition in libraries right now that Lori Ayer, a consultant in California, has referred to as learned helplessness. We have spent so long in a situation where we didn't own our code, we didn't participate in code development, that libraries actually don't know how to do it. It's not that they're not capable of it. And so my job, I've decided that I tried to find a comparison of what I felt like. And I felt like, I think, more like Julia Child than anything else. I'm not a cat herder. I'm not a shepherd. What I do is try to go out and do the demo, and sometimes I drop the chicken on the floor and everybody laughs. But it's to teach librarians how to reengage with the software development process. And we had a great meeting early in September where directors got up and said, one of them said, you know, now I get it. We've never really done anything like this before in Georgia. This is brand new territory, which is amazing because he'd been grumbling about this and that. And he said, you know, this is different. I'm open to this now. And this is a whole new territory for most librarians. Many professional librarians have spent their entire career in a very different software development paradigm. Many of the people out in libraries have spent their career in a very different paradigm. And it does take a kind of shepherding, a willingness to go out there, drop the chicken on the floor, you know, slosh some wine over the stew and laugh at the audience, and to partner with libraries and understanding their role in shaping their concerns. And they often have brilliant ideas, and it's interesting how many great ideas will occur at the same time. Like everybody right now is thinking about Netflix-style queuing. It's like people get Netflix and they say, well, how about we use queues in our hold you know? And it's you'll go out to some library, you know, 300 miles out there with cows out in the pasture, and they're saying, Netflix cues. And it's really exciting. And the other thing I do is I try to listen. And that's important because, you know, it's they often, the librarians in the field, have a real role in this. I also want to talk briefly about the gift economy. I think when Evergreen launched, there was an anticipation there would, be this massive stampede of thousands of library developers to devote millions of hours of time to in kind of a Manhattan Project, to make Evergreen everything that it should be. And that isn't exactly not the case. This is what we thought it would be like, and this is kind of what it is that I once lived an hour from Luxembourg, and I love it. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. It's small. It's a wonderful community, like Luxembourg, a delightful, skilled, and dedicated community, but it's a lot smaller. The actual boots on the ground of people who are able to work in open source development is a lot smaller. Even for hiring, we find it has been difficult. Not impossible, but challenging. That, again, in libraries, there has not been a lot of people who have grown up in the paradigm where we write and maintain our own code. It has been a very different world that we lived in. This is a neutral observation, but this is a illustration of typical library workflow. The slave pulls the papyrus and brings it to the technical services department, who then carefully examines it and catalogs it, which is that end users are all alike, but library workflows are unique. And I know I've worked in academic, public, special, every type of library except prison and ship at this point. And I have not driven a bookmobile yet, although I'd love to. But end users across the board have very similar behaviors and characteristics. Library workflows are sui generis. And it's interesting because Evergreen had initially put a lot of its effort into a flexible backend, and that turns out to have been the right thing. Because every library I go to, you know, you see the same users, they're checking out the same books, they're doing the same things, they have the same search behaviors, and yet every workflow is different. That's just an observation I have from being out there in the field, is that in library software development, it is good to be as flexible, as service-oriented, architecturally oriented as you can be, because every library is going to be different. I also want to talk about something that often happens when you talk about open source, is that somebody says, oh, have you read The Cathedral and the Bazaar? And then they insist that the poor librarian, who is unfamiliar with development in the first place, should sit down and read end-to-end The Cathedral and the Bazaar. How many of you have actually read The Cathedral and the Bazaar end-to-end? Okay, yes, it's kind of like, you know, Thomas Pynchon. There's parts of it, what I tell people is start at about page 140 and then stop 20 pages before the end, and there's some very good points about how open source software development economy makes a lot of sense, in that the code is free and what you pay for is the service, because that's really what you're paying for in libraries anyway with your software, is a service, but you often get shorted on that because you're paying for licensing, and then they don't have money for service because we're a poor community. But anyway, I have found that the rampant recommendation of a book that is a little hard to read has not actually worked in our favor. And if there's one book that I would love to carve out time in my life to write, it would be the response to that. I wanted to do a blog post called the Chapel and the 7-Eleven, just so that I could do a. For those of you who get buttonholed by developers, you can fake your way through understanding The Cathedral and the Bazaar. But once it gets into the hacker milieu and towards the end where it talks about the ghetto of all the poor developers, I think, oh, please. Anyway, so back to the nature of open. Open is great. Open has been terrific for us. There's an amazing amount of things that fall away as problems when your code is open. Communication with vendors, communications with customers, communications with one another. It simply becomes no longer, it's like that great weight of having a secret that you no longer have to keep. Everybody knows about it. And then you're out there, and you don't have to hide it anymore. You no longer have the overhead of hiding your great secret, and you can focus on other things. There is also a great value in the many eyes. Many times I have seen in Evergreen people pouncing on something late at night and saying, oh, you're right, that's broken, and somebody going in and fixing it. It's that there is a whole logic to the idea that with many eyes, all bugs are shallow. And many in a library development community may not be like the 4,000 people who contributed to the last version of Linux, but it is still a lot of eyes, a lot more than in any library software company, even the biggest. And again, I mentioned the network effect, the ability, the more libraries that we have participating in this, the better, and the more diversity, the better. There was initially some hesitation among Pines libraries when Evergreen began to be adopted by other libraries, because they thought that libraries would be competing for attention span with the development of Evergreen. What they found out is, actually, most libraries have very similar needs. Maybe different workflows, but very similar needs. So the same people who were impatient with the lack of documentation for reporting in Michigan, that was good information for the people back at Pines. The same people who like book bags in Missouri, that's development effort we can take back to Pines. So it has turned out to be a good thing to have more and more people involved in Evergreen. It's almost like any problem that you could possibly have, everybody else has as well. And as I mentioned, rapid application development. And the ability to customize. In fact, speaking of this, one of the neat things about having small sites, we have several hosted Evergreen sites now, single sites, is that these are the places where we can roll out things that we're experimenting with, like a non-SIP based web self-check. We've had SIP-based self-check since 1.0, and we have libraries that are using self-check. Believe it or not, the Uncle Remus library system, yes, that is what it is called. You can tell I'm really not originally from the South. It's just an object of great fascination for me as I travel to these places. But to be able to bring up a non-SIP web self-check that you can cobble together, kind of a stone soup self-check, if you've got a monitor and a barcode one and a receipt printer and a PC, you can have self-check. And to be able to test that in a local site without testing it on 275 libraries at once, which we have found sometimes creates some interesting issues. That is really helpful to be able to go live post-release candidate with a single site. So again, that's the value of diversity. And also, to be able to partner with vendors. Vendors can easily look at our code. Right now, in the development of the acquisition systems, we've had 3 webinars where we've invited a whole slew of people, including vendors. And to get people, to get our partners in early on development is really good. And not to have any hesitation about what they're seeing or what we're seeing or what we're talking about. You know, coming out of Dynex, DRAX, Libris, you name it, libraries, where we couldn't do that, where we had to basically do our own preparation in a silo and have these very complicated communications where everybody was afraid what the other person would see. And after spending some time sitting in on the NSIP working group at NISO, where you know you could see always this hesitation about what they were sharing. It's nice to be again in an environment where the secret's off the table. You know, it's not an issue. Look at our code. Vendors love that. They bob their heads. Yes, oh please, easy to do. You know, one of the arguments that is made a lot about open source is that it's less costly. Marshall Breeding has disputed that, but Georgia Public Library Service has said, in fact, that they did experience significant first and second year cost savings with Evergreen. My concern about that is that it can be a dangerous argument, because it can be saying that this is the software of last resort. You know, this is the software that you go to when you don't have money. There is some logic to open source software being less expensive overall than licensed software, being more affordable, and especially being able to funnel more money into development. But I just caution you that you don't want to implement open source software simply because you think it's going to be less expensive. Because what's that saying is that you're really waiting for the good stuff to come along. You know, it's sort of like me fumbling with Audacity when I really want to be using SoundForge. No lock-in is a big deal. It's one of the greatest things that we can offer with Evergreen is the security of not being locked into software in the future. And interoperability, as I mentioned, is a big plus. I also, this is something that doesn't get talked about much, but I've become a big fan of meritocracies. I've come out of many libraries where everything was done by committee, and you had to have a democratic process, and everybody had to have a say, whether maybe they were supposed to have a say or not, or really qualified to be speaking on something. The development community is almost remorselessly merit-based. You know, the best code wins. The best developers get the most recognition. That is really a good thing. It contributes to positives all around. And I've really become, I guess, I was in the military for 8 years, and that, too, in many ways, is a kind of meritocracy. They don't have time not to be, not for there not to be the very best. When you're launching a plane, you can't have it, you know, crash. Oh, I'm sorry, I just wasn't on my game that day. You know, it's, you know. Next one won't be so bad, you know. You have to be able to produce a good product every day. And there is some, there's some real interesting value to the idea that we do reward people who do the best work in the system. And there is this mysterious commit process that developers are often reluctant. I've actually had library administrators sit me down and say, so tell me, how does code get committed? Can anybody commit code? And I say, well, not exactly. Can I modify the code myself? Yes. Well, that will become part of the permanent code. So then I have to talk about how there is this mysterious but somehow workable meritocracy in source, open source development, where some people get to ultimately be able to commit changes to the code. And that is like the highest honor, I suppose. And it's an interesting concept, and I know that one that I see library administrators' eyes get a little dreamy sometimes when they think about that. I've become, it's sometimes politically incorrect to say so, but a big fan of meritocracies. I'm also a big fan of dog fooding, which is the flip side of this. And dog fooding, how many of you know the phrase dog fooding? Handful. A user experience phrase comes from eating your own dog food, which is an expression that means that you use your own product. I am a huge fan of dog fooding. In my couple of months on the Pine system, I have created my own user ID, which I love because I can never remember my barcode. I mean, heavens. I have forgotten my password. I have gone overdue on items, placed about 40 holds, picked up books, canceled holds, returned books, had books shipped around from library to library. And basically, I am a pretty intense user of the system myself. So, you know, a librarian last week said to me, you know that page, you know that record page? I said, yeah, the one that's missing the hold button? She said, yeah, that, exactly. So I didn't have to say to her, I know what you're talking about. You're right, that page does need a hold button. You get to the last page and you can't see it. I'm a big fan of dog fooding because it really puts you in touch with your product. I also think one of the interesting things about open source is because the code's not secret is you can start to develop training materials way in advance. There's actually a slew of training materials, and they're all out in the open on Evergreen, and that is really great, too, the idea that training, again, is not a cloak and dagger thing. And then again, one of the things that I've noticed is that as Evergreen turned into a viable product and grew and grew and grew, is that the FUD began to fly. And FUD stands for fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And it's the kind of rumors that get spread around products that you want to make people feel uncomfortable about using. This is a particular sort of FUD I'm familiar with all the time, is, you know, walking into an airport, you know, the Tallahassee airport, and being told there's a significant risk of terror attacks. You know, it's like, we only just got our second baggage terminal. Why would we, you know? They took away the coffee bar. They turned off the Wi-Fi, and they didn't even sell the New York Times yesterday. I mean, what kind of terrorist would be coming to Tallahassee? One of the pieces of FUD that you hear about open source in general, and sometimes about Evergreen, is that it's only used in third world countries, which would include Georgia. And of course, in the South, there's a pecking order. So, you know, when I drive north from Florida, I announced that I'm bringing my passport and going into Georgia, a third world country. That would make Michigan and Indiana third world countries as well. You know, another one is that it's not mature. Open source software isn't mature. You know, that's actually not a bad thing in software code. And for some of you working with older systems with nasty old COBOL or whatever is in their back end, you know, maturity is not necessarily a good thing in software. It's the opposite of saying it's newer. And also that, you know, again, and this is actually where sometimes we're our own worst enemies, the stereotype of the open source development community where they're, you know, saying information wants to be free, and well it does, and, you know, all the truisms of open source development, and the guy in the garage, and, you know, patiently coding. And, you know, actually we have very nice offices in Norcross, and, you know, we all drive cars, and we wear clothes to work and everything. So all those things. But I wanted to bring up Rosie Live, if I could. By the way, this is, again, the area of the Pines, and I should do a whole map for all of the evergreen plantings. I thought I would briefly search. There's only like three records or four in our, so. But this is the, again, it's an early prototype, and but this is the forthcoming available skin for Evergreen. The classic skin will still be available, but this is a new one, and it's quite beautiful. And it does not yet have built in some of the social networking features that we've been talking about. Again, one thing about Pines is, we developed what we needed to develop first to replace what we had. That didn't mean that we didn't have forward vision, but we had to put the priorities first on replacing the system. I've also brought up the acquisition server if anybody wants to see it. But oops, sorry. I've gotten a little. Anyway, that's really what I had, dispatches from the field of open source software in 2008. I hope this was interesting. I hope you pepper me with questions, heckle me, complain, criticize my reading tastes. How much time do we have left for Q&A? Do we? Oh, okay. Did I talk fast? That's okay. Well, thank you. And fire away. Ask me some questions.